Data visualizations are everywhere, showing up in social media, on the news, and on company websites. With this onslaught, it can be hard to know what visualizations to trust. Deciphering dishonest charts is a focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association in partnership with Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. Joining me, as always, is regular panelist John Baylor, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at Miami University. Our guest today is Nathan Yao. Yao is the author of two books on data visualization, Visualize This and Data Points. He also runs the Flowing Data blog, where he works to make the process of creating data visualizations accessible to a wide audience. He recently published their Defense Against Dishonest Charts, a guide to figuring out what visualizations to trust. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
How did Flowing Data get started?
It was actually a grad school project that I had to put online. And so I bought some hosting for, I don't know, $3 a month. And then it came with a free domain. And the class was called Data Flows. And Data Flows was taken. So I took flowingdata.com. And then from there, it just sort of, it became a site where I documented things that I learned and thought that was interesting. And I just continued it through school. And I started posting my own projects as I learned more. And it just kind of grew from there. And then after I graduated, it just kept going. And so now it's kind of what I do.
That's pretty good gig to start that in grad school and have this seed grows into this incredible product. Congratulations on that.
Thanks.
Yeah, you know, I first encountered some of your work not through the website, but through your first book, the Visualize This. And when I was developing a data viz class, your structure and organization proved to be just really quite useful. And there are probably students that now curse both you and me because you were assigned reading in this class. So I'm curious, what inspired you to write this first book?
It stemmed a lot from the blog because I would make a lot of projects. I still publish a lot of projects on Flowing Data. And if it becomes popular, then people wonder how I made it. And so I would have to explain to a lot of people how I made it. And I would write tutorials sometimes. But then as it kept going, more projects and just more inquiries, then the book became sort of a natural extension of the site. I try to make it less technical and try to make data fun and approachable to people who don't necessarily always work with data. And so Visualize This was my attempt to make visualization less stuffy and sort of, I guess, fun in a way that where they could people could chart maybe their data in their own lives and see how the charts are a representation of, you know, what they see in the world, and then kind of explore it from there and answer their own questions.
So one of the things that struck me was that you had a pretty interesting internship when you were a student. So you spent some time in the world of journalism.
Yeah, it was at the New York Times, and it was I was just getting started in visualization because I had told my advisor Mark Hansen that I wanted to go into visualization, but I didn't really know in what regard. And at that point, it was just I like making charts. And publishing it to making it for reports mostly and analysis, kind of like the John Tukey area, where it's more of exploratory data analysis. But then I went to the New York Times, and that completely changed my perspective on what visualization can be used for and who you are communicating to, because you have millions of people instead of, you know, yourself or a handful of people. And so it was about explaining the data in less technical ways. And I mean, that's sort of kind of like the basis or core of what Flowing Data is now.
How do you decide what you're going to write about for Flowing Data?
It's very much about my own curiosities. So if you go back, the beginning projects are very much my own explorations of what visualization is, because I don't know what I'm doing. I very clearly don't know what I'm doing, and which is a good thing at sometimes, because you don't know what you're restricted by. So you just keep doing whatever you want and just disregarding all the rules. And then, but more recently, it's very much about what's going on in my life. And so you end up with things like relationships, aging, having children, when people have children. And as I get, I'm pretty squarely in middle age now, and so I'm very much about, I think about aging a lot because just my body tells me so that I should probably think about it.
You also pick a lot of really important data sets. I think things like the American Time Use Survey is one that seems to be a real favorite of yours in a lot of
It
this. Are
is, yeah, that is my favorite. It is my favorite data set, just because the data is so granular that you can look at one person and you can see what they did during that day. And then you can kind of, it's been going on since, I don't remember the beginning year, but it's been going for a while. So you can see, what people were doing then and what they're doing now, and then bring it all together to see what the aggregate is. And it gets really, like, really detailed because it's just a journal of people entering things, and then those activities were encoded by someone else and to for a more analytical approach. But it's fun to look at the anecdotes.
When you've been doing these explorations as part of the flowingdata.com, what has been kind of the most surprising insight that you've gained from one of these visualizations?
Let's see. So Flowing Data is seven, going on 18 years old now. And so there's been a lot of charts, but the one that jumps out in my mind is when I looked at how people meet and stay together data set from Stanford University Research. I don't remember the department, but they surveyed people how they meet and how they stay together, and sort of kind of look at their timeline of when they start dating, when they get engaged, when they become romantic, and when they get married and live together. And so I plotted every single one. It's sort of similar to the time use thing, where you could see the individual's timeline. And if you plot all of them, it's sort of everyone is kind of the standard, more traditional timeline, where you start dating in your early 20s, and then a few years later you get married, you live together. But then there's this one outlier that you can see because of the way that I made it, because of like the little dots that are moving around of individuals getting together, and so they meet 40 years prior, and then they stay friends for a very, very long time, and then something happens where they become romantic, and then they eventually live together, and then 40 years later they finally get married. And so I think that's like a very beautiful thing to see in a data set. I had presented that as in a talk, and then this couple came up to me, there, and they had a similar timeline, that they were so thrilled to see themselves in the data, because they came up to me and they're like, that was us, we were those people. So I really like visualizing data in a way that individuals could see themselves in some way. And so that was, I mean, the talk was very specifically about seeing yourself in the data, and they came up and saw themselves in the data, and so I felt very satisfied in what it showed.
On Flowing Data, you have several of these guides, and one of them is the one that I mentioned in the open to the show, Defense Against Dishonest Charts. And I'm just wondering what propelled you to create that.
I guess there are a lot of things are happening right now that, where as statisticians, we're seeing, data being taken down and charts showing maybe the truth and maybe not the truth. And so it's been going on for a long time, but I think in these recent times, and especially going forward, that there's going to be more misleading charts that are harder to decipher if they are real or not. And that's partly it's from maybe generative AI type things, and maybe it's from people or organizations that have agendas that they want to push. I think as a whole, it's in everyone's best interest to be able to, at least read a chart and figure out what is wrong with it. And in my experience, a lot of people will say a chart is misleading because maybe they don't agree with it, or it doesn't match their expectations. But technically the chart is fine. It's just that the person or the group who made it is showing a different angle. And that's, you know, that's part of the fun part of, that's the fun part of data where you can see many angles, but it can also be used for bad things. And so I tried to make a guide that was very visual, very interactive, and very easy to see how small changes can make a big difference in what the data shows.
You know, before we start diving into some of the these anomalies, misleading ways that people can deal with charts and this aspects of it, could you talk, give us a structure here? And you do that beautifully in the blog post about what is the anatomy of a chart, particularly these ideas of encoding and scaling.
Yeah, I mean, because I guess to understand visualization, people kind of like look at the chart as a whole, because in Excel, you just have spreadsheet, then it outputs a chart. But I think it's very important to understand the components of it. And there are various ways to break it down. But the way that I go about it for as big as audience as I can, who's going to pay attention to, you know, something about dishonest charts. I break it up into visual encodings, the things that represent the data, like shapes and lines and geometries, angles. And then I go into the scales, which dictate how those encodings represent the numbers. Like, is it big? Is it small? And then those are just like the main components that you put together to form different types of charts. Like a standard bar chart is the visual encoding is going to have, is going to use length for the bars. The longer the bar, the higher the value. And then there's the scales that dictate what that length of the bar represents. And so once we go into, you know, everything means, how things can change, I go into, you know, try to show very generally how those small changes can shift the point of view. And then from there, we go into the types of what that different, very specific ways that people shift those things to show the data in the way that they want.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Nathan Yao of Flowing Data.
Well, there's certainly a large set of options for kind of being misleading with graphics. I mean, it's a, you know, and we want to make sure that people don't think of this as a how-to guide. This is self-defense. So as you go through this, you know, you start with it starts with damper and it goes all the way to faker and descriptor. Of the list of these, you know, what is your you think is your favorite in the sense of most frequently detected of these misleading variations?
Yeah, I have one called the storyteller, which is where you have a single data set, but depending on what section you look at and how much of it you look at and what scale you look at it, is going to tell very, very different stories. And so I have, in this example, I use the percentage of NBA shots that are three-pointers over the years. And so if you zoom into, you know, like a very small section, you can say that three-pointers are down. But if you keep going, you can see that three-pointers are up. And they only went down because of the three-point line was moved and people just changed their behaviors, but then they adjusted and then kind of it went up again. And so we see this in, you know, non-basketball context all the time, where people are, they have the story first and then they just kind of, you know, poke at the data to try to get that story. And that's kind of the root of a lot of misleading charts that happen.
A lot of these charts on this guide are interactive in nature, and I am just sort of wondering, how did you decide what was going to be interactive, and what are you hoping people get out of playing with these charts?
Yeah, because this was many years ago, I had made a guide about misleading charts, and it was static. And since then, I've read other guides that are about misleading charts. And they're always, while they're to the point and they explain what it is, it's very hard to see it. And just the interaction was probably I felt like interaction was the key component that was missing in these guides, just because it's, you know, it's, if you're saying like the scale has to be shrunk and then has to be grown and then increase this, increase that, things get bigger and smaller and you don't actually see it, then it's kind of It's hard, very hard to imagine. So I made it interactive, and I tried to make it an easy interaction where it was consistent across all the charts and all the types, so that you could see the changes right away.
You know, as you were talking about the storyteller, that kind of tied to my favorite. If I had my top four in your list, I mean, that storyteller tied a lot to cherry picker in terms of filtering the data points you show. But I also thought, you know, the time gap, base stealer, and overbinner are also were three of the others that kind of surfaced for me beyond kind of that storyteller cherry picker. Can you talk about one or two of those as how they play out?
The time gap one is sort of my favorite one, because I used baby name data, which might be my second favorite data set behind the time use, just because it's so consistent and everyone can relate to that right away because they can look at their own name. I looked at my own name, and to show everyone how Nathan has become, really great name, how it has become super popular. Everybody wants to be Nathan. So it shows counts for 1960, 1970, and 2010, and it shows a very steep increase with between 1970 and 2010. But it's missing, all the years in between 1960 and 1970, several decades. So as we zoom out and we fill the gaps in time, we can see that, Nathan has increased, but maybe it's also on its way down. And again, I think it's a variant of the cherry picker, which is people are just picking points and then seeing what fills their narrative and just going from there.
So one of the things you do within this piece is that you suggest some strategies for reading data, you know, so that you're kind of, okay, now that you've seen some of these things, here's what I suggest you do. Can you talk through some of those with us?
Sure. So in case it's not obvious, this is very like Harry Potter based, because my kids are very into Harry Potter, and I kind of like was trying to figure out like the framing of how I would talk about misleading charts. And I didn't want to just talk about charts that lie. I wanted to talk about, like, if you see a chart, then what do you do? And so it occurred to me that there were spells and counterspells in Harry Potter. And so in this defense against the dishonest charts is that there's something that's misleading, and then there's a counter chart that you can kind of explain it. So for example, the cherry picker is going to, which is a chart, right, that shows the percentage of people who wear glasses given your age. I recently had to get glasses. I had perfect vision for a very long time and was very proud of that. And then I went to the optometrist, and they told me in about a year I would not be able to read closely, so, and I would have to get glasses. So I've been looking at that data set a lot. But if you look at the cherry picker in the initial view, is like 59 to 60 year olds. It shows a very gentle decline where fewer 60 year olds wear glasses than 59 year olds, where you would expect more people to wear glasses as they get older, as so. The counter chart to that is to point out that there's a wider age range than 1 year between 59 and 60. So you use the slider, and it shows the full percentage range from age 18 to 85, where you can see, of course, where there's a sudden spike in the percentage of people who have to wear glasses, which happens to be around my age, and then it kind of levels out around, 60s in the 70s. And if you're wearing glasses, then by, 60, you're probably going to be, I mean, you're going to wear glasses, and then a lot of people, I guess, don't wear glasses. I don't know how that goes. I'll tell you when I get to that age.
So Visualize This is in its second edition, and you have data points. Do you have plans for other books that might be based on the work you've been doing for Flowing Data?
Not right now. Some people have suggested that I turn something like Dishonest Charts into a book, which could be a possibility. But for me, most of my work is online, so I've tried to focus on that, where I have I write a lot of guides and courses online through Flowing Data, and so I try to focus on that for now.
Yeah, I think that it I, as I was thinking about that idea of what you just described of expanding on this into a book, I think the interactivity and the sliders for exploring the concepts is such a powerful technique for letting kind of the person who's encountering the information interact with it directly. So I you know, as someone who does like books and who's been involved in writing them, I still think that there's some things that this type of direct connection and manipulation seems to be powerful. How do you think about that in terms of static versus interactive displays when you're working through problems?
I always try to go as basic as I can first, and then if it needs interaction as I'm making the basic view, then I try to go more advanced. So with this, again, it was I had made a bunch of static charts at first. I've done various guides where you have a single data set, and I've made many, many charts based on a single data set to show that it has various angles. But I felt like it was missing the interaction, because when you have the static, it's you see view, and then there's a break, like visual break, and there's another view, but you can't see the transition, how it got there. So in this point with this guide, the interaction was very important to see how you got there. And I've also tried it with animation, which is another way to get from point A to point B. But with animation, a lot of time people are going to, I guess, to be satisfied with what you show them with the animate, like the animation plays and they just watch it go, and they might miss something. With the interaction, you can kind of, it's fun. For me, it's fun to just like shift it back and forth and swing it around. And so just with that, if you have someone playing with it, then you kind of have a deeper understanding of how it happens.
You know, when we were starting this conversation, one of the things you said about people misreading charts was kind of your prior belief shaping how you consume a graphic. What kind of ideas do you have about trying to address that? You know, if you know that there's sort of kind of this visceral response that someone who may not agree with conclusions from it, how are ways that you could anticipate and possibly integrate that into a display?
Okay, I'll start with the default approach, which a lot of people like to do, is they're worried that they're going to offend a lot of people, or that they're going to show an angle that a lot of people don't agree with, but they know that it's true. So they will compensate by showing as many angles as possible, all the angles, and it could be this, it could be that, and annotate as much as possible, and they go overboard with showing as everything instead of focusing on what they actually wanted to show. And by so I by showing trying to show everything, they end up showing nothing, because it just ends up as like a garble of charts. And so my approach is usually to focus on the question that I'm trying to answer, and I'm trying to make a chart that specifically answers that single question the best that I can. And people might not agree with that answer, but I know that what I'm showing is, to the best of my ability, is honest to the data. And there are always different ways to see that data, and I always point people to the data source, so that if they disagree, or they think it's a different way, that they're always able to go to that data set. And so I think the weird thing is that most people don't go to the data set. Like, the people who strongly disagree don't look at it themselves. They just want to disagree. And so there's and with flowing data, just because of like a very general audience, there's always going to people who very vehemently just disagree with what you have, no matter how innocent that I'm, like, I'm talking about glasses or something like that. People like to disagree about things, and sometimes you just have to ignore it, and other times you can take it in and think of a different angle that you can talk about later, and it becomes like a kind of a continuous narrative of how you're looking at a data set.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Nathan, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, David.
Thanks a lot.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. You can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places where you find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net and be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.